Hi, I'm John Coe, and welcome to Icons of DC Area Real Estate, a one-on-one interview show highlighting the backgrounds and career trajectory of leading luminaries in the Washington, D.C. area real estate market. The purpose of the show is to highlight their backgrounds and their experiences and some interesting stories about their current business as well as their past, and to cite some things that you might take away, both from educational standpoint as well as lessons learned in the industry, and some amusing and sometimes interesting background stories. So I'm hoping that you will enjoy the show. Before I introduce my guest for this episode, I want to share some information about Coe Enterprises, my company. It serves income-producing real estate market participants through four distinct platforms. First, I advise early-stage real estate companies on securing project financing and on forming and executing operating and financial strategy. My current clients include Brick Lane, a multifamily investment and development firm who began in D.C. and has expanded to the Southeast U.S. with many acquisitions and projects, and One Circle Co., an early-stage multifamily developer and investor in Boston who is nearing their first development project. Two, career counseling for early and mid-career real estate professionals with a program approach, including 2 one-hour sessions and follow-up 6 months progress reports. My clients range from recent college graduates to mid-career executives who are contemplating change. And three, of course, this podcast, sharing knowledge and insights of market leaders. I want to give a special shout out to my associate on this effort, Colin Madden, who provides postscript perspective and marketing assistance to produce the podcast. And finally, for deriving from the podcast listener base and my experience as a ULI mentor, Colin and I initiated the iconic journey in CRE, a community of young professionals from 22 to 40 years old who participate and contribute to online and live meetings, property tours, mastermind groups, book readings, and career resources. In summary, Coe Enterprises' mission is to motivate and guide high-achieving individuals and young companies to get the results they want, and in doing so, to elevate the DC area real estate community. To learn more, click on my website, coenterprises.com, or reach out to me at john@coenterprises.com to learn about any of these services. Thank you for listening. Thank you for joining me for another episode of Icons of DC Area Real Estate. My guest for today's show is David Rudberg, who is the new president of the Menchetti Group, a 15-year-old minority-based company led by Bo Menchetti that is diversified in many different disciplines in both the residential and the commercial sector. David joined Bo after 20 years with Horning Brothers, which he led the firm and led them through three major developments during that term and oversaw a portfolio of about 4,000 residential units. David was at a point in his career that he wanted some change. He had stepped down, giving them 18 months notice, but then Bo came to him after knowing him for so many years and said, you know, maybe we should work something out. So they came to an agreement, which was exciting. David grew up in New Jersey. He went to school at Duke and then Michigan for his master's degree. Wasn't sure what he wanted to do. He spent a couple years at EDS and Perpetual in the interim, and then was heard about an opportunity to combine properties, joined them, and spent 8 years there during the 90s and learned the retail industry and finance. Was mostly a Mr. Inside guy, a CFO, but he had to handle family squabbles with the Haft family, which was an interesting conversation we get into. And then he joined a tech firm for a couple of years and realized that that wasn't going to work during the tech bust. So then Horning Brothers had attracted him. So this is an interesting conversation where David initially was challenged with shyness and not being able to earn a job opportunity out of business school, and realized that he had to do something about it. And he did, became very active in the community with relationships and building relationships both inside and outside the work situation, and built up his credibility in the marketplace, and was really very proud of that. So without further ado, please enjoy this wide-ranging conversation with David Rudberg. So David Rudberg, welcome to Icons of DC Area Real Estate. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you. I look forward to it.
Great. So congratulations on your new position as president of the Menchetti Group. You left Horning Brothers after leading them for about 20 years. Perhaps share your role here at Menchetti and why you decided to make the move at the high level, and then we'll dive into the details a little bit later.
Sure. There were actually two different decisions. My first decision was to leave Horning, which I had made without any plans at the time. I just knew I was ready for a transition in life. Over time, as I was thinking about what I wanted to do next, I had a long relationship with Bo Menchetti, and I'll talk about that more later. And as I got involved in more discussions with him, was really excited about what he was doing and was looking to have the opportunity to be part of that.
Awesome. That's great. So let's flip the Wayback Machine and look at your origins. So if you could tell me where you're from and your background and your parental influences, if you could.
Sure. So I'm from northern New Jersey, Bergen County, a small town called Closter. Pretty typical family. My dad worked in the garment industry in New York, commuted in every day. My mom stayed at home at times, and at times taught nursery school. Mm-hmm. My dad, and I have one sister who's younger. So probably no background in real estate or anything like that, and we'll get into that. But I think my dad was a hard worker, had long commutes each day, probably focused more on the family than a lot of fathers of his generation. He actually ran the errands for the family, did groceries, things like that. I think in the late 60s and 70s, it probably wasn't that common. So I appreciated that, and I appreciated, you know, the importance of hard work and family from my childhood.
So if he did that, what did your mom do?
that's a good question. But she also, you know, she was involved in, you know, things around the house. And as I said, she taught nursery school. But my, you know, my dad was probably the bigger influence as far as, you know, who I was as a, you know, child and growing up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So was he an entrepreneur, or was he kind of he worked with another manufacturer or what?
Yeah, no, he actually was a salesman.
Oh, sales.
He was a salesman. He worked for a company that made ladies and children's underwear. It was based out of North Carolina. Their sales office was in New York City.
Textile industry.
Exactly.
Yep, exactly. It's ironic. I just interviewed Todd Rich from Northern. He was from Northern New Jersey, and his father was in the textile industry as well. Third generation American, you know, so, which isn't unusual. So where did you go to high school? And where did you go to school and high school there in Northern New Jersey?
Sure. It was a high school called Demarest High School. It was a regional high school, a lot of small towns up there as opposed to your bigger cities around here and things like that. And, you know, I was basically a typical, you know, nerd. I was insecure, but I was a nerd. I focused on academics. I was I really enjoyed sports, but I was not as good as I hoped I was, but, you know, probably pretty typical. So I was a nerd. And as I started to think about where I went next, initially, you know, my thoughts were, you know, being a doctor. I was good in math and science, having a Jewish upbringing, you know, being the Jewish doctor was something that you think about.
Sure.
And that played a big role in, you know, in thinking about where to go to college and next steps.
So did that lead you to Duke University then?
It did. I went to Duke. I had a chance to visit Duke. I think it was in March. And so coming from the New York area, had the chance to go down and visit Duke, and the weather was really nice. Mm-hmm. And I said, gosh, I have the opportunity to go get some good academics and better weather.
Very good school.
So it was probably, and they had a strong program.
Of course.
We met. And so that was a big part of why I decided to go to Duke, was the good good academics, good pre-med program, and have milder weather. It seemed like a good combination.
Did you enjoy Duke?
I did enjoy it. Obviously, I ended up not becoming a doctor. We saw that. So as I got there, and I did start with all the pre-med classes, like a lot of people.
Organic chemistry and all the fun things.
Well, I never did take organics. I was smart enough to decide I wasn't interested in medicine before taking organic chemistry. But I did take the intro chems and the intro bio and classes like that. But then I started realizing that it wasn't really the sciences that I enjoyed. It was really more the math and analytical side of things. And so I said, you know, I don't really want to stick with this. And that's when I sort of transitioned to computer science. And everybody today looks at computer science as such a, you know, popular thing to do and an exciting thing to do. Back then, it wasn't as big a deal. My freshman computer science class at Duke, we used punch cards.
Yeah, I did too.
Carrying the punch cards too. And then hoping you don't drop them on the way to the room. And then you felt really good. You advanced to having the dumb terminals.
Right.
And then at least then you're working on a terminal that's connected and waiting for the big printer that everybody's sharing for your program.
Then
finding out your program didn't really run and then up all night. So
Been there, done that.
Exactly. So it wasn't until my senior year at Duke that they actually had some PCs on campus. Mm-hmm. And those were the first time. And I actually was one of the early adopters of that on campus, because between my junior and senior year at Duke, I was a counselor and teaching assistant in Duke Computer Camp over a summer for high school students.
Oh, that's great.
And so I learned a lot about it then, and then I was able to TA class, introductory computer science classes as a senior. So that was...
What languages did you learn there? Basic?
Fortran, Basic, COBOL, PL1,
okay,
and Pascal.
Sure. Those are all the ones I remember.
All those.
We had one at Michigan called Lot5, which was an unusual blending of Fortran and another one. It's kind of another setup. But Duke's, did they have two programs? Did they have was it in the literature school or was it in the engineering school, the computer science program?
Yeah, it was in the arts and science.
Arts and science.
It was not in the engineering school. And I know you went to University of Michigan, and there they have it in both programs.
That's right.
And actually, my son got a computer science degree from the engineering school at Michigan.
Right.
So, but no, for Duke, it wasn't as tech, I have to say, my computer science degree.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it was programming and tech, but not as hardcore as some places.
So speaking of Michigan, you went there for your graduate degree. Was that right out of college, or did you go someplace else in between?
It was right out of college, which I know nowadays nobody really does it that way. I had the degree in computer science, but I knew I didn't want to be a programmer.
Mm-hmm.
The options were like go to an IBM or something like that and be a programmer. I knew I didn't want to do that. So I said, okay, I really would like to use the analytical side of what I'm doing and maybe get a finance degree. And Michigan was one of the stronger schools that accepted people straight from college. So I don't know that I would necessarily recommend that. And I know most schools today don't even accept most people doing it. And I realized later why it may not have been, you know, the best thing to do, but I think it was right for me at the time. I didn't really want to go do programming.
Why business school? Why not law school or someplace else, some other discipline?
Because I really liked the concept of business, the concept of analysis, and particularly the finance side of things. I wasn't the best writer. So the idea of like law school and all the writing, I knew that was not my strength.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do, but I thought business school made sense.
Mm-hmm. Why Michigan? Why not another school?
Well, I think Michigan, once again, was a strong school that it was willing to accept people straight from undergrad and had a strong finance program. And a strong management information systems, which tied to my undergraduate degree in computer science.
That's great. So did you enjoy your experience in Ann Arbor?
I did. Cold weather, but I did enjoy I did enjoy my experience.
Very cold there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you went through your program there. You were a finance major in the business school?
That's correct.
And, you know, did you look at other things? What were your options when you came out? What were you looking at?
So one would typically think with my background in undergraduate in computer science, MBA in finance, going to Silicon Valley would be a natural step. And it's actually what I wanted to do. There's a reason I didn't end up doing it, though. And that was, and I think part of it was because I went straight from undergrad to business school. I think I sort of lacked a certain business maturity in some way. So I had, in the interview process, I did well enough in first interviews to have 11 second interviews. A number of them were out in Silicon Valley on the West Coast.
Yep.
And I didn't get a single job offer. I was the only, even though I did really well in business school, I was the only one of my friends who didn't get a single job offer. And in a way, it was a good failure. Because if I had gotten one, I would have thought everything was okay. But because I got none, I realized that developing interpersonal skills, relationship skills, was more important. And I put a lot of effort into that after that embarrassment. Mm-hmm. And in a way, that was a good thing because it helped me grow from that. So,
Who told you that? Nobody told me that.
I just learned that when you go 0 for 11 in interviewing, you're like, okay, the problem must be me and not the interviewers. And
That's interesting.
So it was a self-revelation.
It was a self-revelation,
and I ended up taking Dale Carnegie classes.
Really?
I ended up working on the relationship side and interpersonal side of this. So what ended up happening is I went home for the summer. I didn't have a job yet. I ultimately did get one with EDS, the Ross Perot Day.
Sure, right.
Out of Dallas. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a great position. It was in their accounting and finance program. And I didn't really like EDS a lot. Ross Perot, if you know, came from the Naval Academy, IBM, had to wear a white shirt, tie every day, very bureaucratic, much more structured than I was comfortable with. So I realized pretty quickly it wasn't a fit.
Was this in New Jersey?
This was in Dallas.
Oh, in Dallas. You went down to
Dallas. Well, I went down to Dallas. And then this program, they put you into different cities. Mm-hmm. And by the third rotation, I knew I didn't want to stay. So as opposed to picking a position I liked, I picked a city I thought would be good to go to. And of the cities they gave me a choice of, I picked D.C. And that was because I thought it was a good balance from going to Duke and being from the New York area. It was in between. I had a lot of friends from Duke I had visited in the D.C. area. So I said, okay, this would be a good job to go to. Mm-hmm. It was an awful job. It was cost accounting on government contracts. And we had to work through Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year to try to put these proposals in. And I knew I wanted out. But it got me to a good city, D.C., that I've come to love. And after that, I ended up getting the job, interviewing for different jobs, and I got a job at Perpetual Savings Bank at that point in time.
So were you in Chantilly in the office, the big office that EDS had out there, or was it another spot where they were at the time?
Yeah. So I started in Dallas, and then I went to Detroit with EDS when they were bought by GM, and then I came to Rockville.
Oh, Rockville. Okay.
So they had an office in Rockville. Okay. It was before they built the big Chantilly location.
Got it. Okay. And then you joined,
Perpetual
Savings. Yes. Okay. We're in downtown?
That was in Alexandria.
Oh, okay.
It was in Alexandria, their headquarters. They were downtown at one point at 11th and E, and then they moved to Alexandria.
Okay.
And I was in the consumer banking division, and I started as a financial analyst, and then I got promoted to be a divisional controller and assistant director of procedures and special projects. I was there for about 2.5 years.
That's quite a shift from EDS to Perpetual Bank.
It was.
That's a different culture.
It was, it was definitely different. It was just for a few years, but I enjoyed it there and made some good friends, and but realized that I wanted to do something different than banking at the time.
Mm-hmm. So where'd you catch the real estate bug then?
Well, it's interesting because I never had interest in real estate. I even remember at Michigan, somebody coming up and saying, oh, I got this great job opportunity with real estate with Trammell Crowe and real estate during that time.
Of course,
and
yeah.
I'm like, oh, that's not something I would want to do. So what happened to me is a friend came to me about the job opportunity at Combined Properties in early 89 and in finance to be a financial analyst and systems manager, more financial. And would I be interested? I said, I'm a finance person. I knew nothing about real estate, but that sounds interesting. Why don't I go look into that? And I ended up interviewing and taking the position. And here we are, whatever, 30-some years later, and
right.
having loved real estate and having a career in it and making a huge difference in my life. But my first day on the job, to give you my lack of knowledge of real estate, my boss asked me to do a CAM reconciliation, and I didn't even know what CAM stood for. I had to go ask somebody in the office, what is this that they're asking me to do? So that was my start in real estate.
So who did you interview with when you got a job? Do you remember?
I do. It was somebody you know, Gene Patton.
Okay.
So if you remember Gene was the CFO at the time.
All right. Was Ron running the company at that point?
Ron
Haft?
Ron was running the company at the time.
Okay, so he must have just got there, because I know Gary was there up until about 87 or so.
Yeah, this was, I started February of 89.
Actually, it was 84 by.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I started February of 89.
Okay. And so talk about your career at Combined a little bit.
So I was at Combined for 11 years.
Yeah.
And I started as a financial analyst. And then I was promoted to treasurer. And then, and this was fairly quickly. And then our CFO left. They brought in another one who didn't work out. So they made me interim CFO. And I did well enough in the position at that point in time that they decided to make me CFO.
And what year was that?
That was 91. So 91. Or
right, 92. Right around the real problems that the industry had at that point. So were you doing a lot of workouts at that point? Or?
We weren't doing a lot of workouts, but we were doing a lot of converting our short-term debt, our lines of credit, from into longer-term loans. And I think that's when we first met. And we were trying to convert a lot of it. I remember going to the Mortgage Bankers Association conference in 92, and the key phrase was stay alive till 95.
That's right.
Yes. And,
that's right.
But, you know, even with the challenges, and as we look at today, it also brings opportunity.
Oh, sure.
I mean, I remember buying a property, you know, combined buying a property in late 92. We actually closed in January 93. That was in bankruptcy for $14 million that had been built for $40 million, a retail center. So
sure.
There are tough times, but they provide opportunities. So, yeah, in my early time was definitely a challenge. And then, as you know, that headed into the family dispute. Which
yeah, talk a little bit about that, if you would, your perspective of it.
Sure.
Because I've had Kathy Robertson on before, Kathy Bonifay on before, who talked about it.
Yeah, and we had different roles during it, so it's interesting. So for those that aren't aware, Combined Properties is owned by the Haft family, who had one of the more high-profile family conflicts, not just in the D.C. region, but in the entire country. And the family dispute involved the real estate company that I worked for, Combined Properties, their retail companies, Crown Books, Track Auto, Shoppers Food
Warehouse,
Dart Drug, exactly. And a family fight, a divorce and aspects. And so the fight initially started sort of between, if you want to look at the world as taking sides, Herb, the patriarch, and his younger son, Ron, who ran Combined. And then the other side was his wife, Gloria, and two other children, Robert and Linda. Mm-hmm. And so they got into the fight. So Kathy played a big role because of the family fight, it forced the business into bankruptcy to protect itself. I played a bigger role on the family side and negotiating family agreements and working through that, which was an interesting situation.
But you're in the real estate business, so why would you be involved in family discussions, etc.? Was that just
because
transactional things? And
it was a transaction. So much of it was about the real estate and settling and splitting up the real estate.
Got
and
it.
Understanding that.
Okay.
And DART was public and Combine was private. So I have all kinds of stories on that my entire life. The one I'll share just for fun. So Herbert Haft has, was famous. He's passed away now for being, negotiating by intimidation. I mean, he was a tough person. So initially, Herb and Ronnie, because they were working on the real estate, I was working with, and I had worked with Herb on other transactions, and I had seen him intimidate people. And I was like, okay, I'm working with him. That'd be good. But then when the first family dispute settled, Herb and Ron couldn't agree on things, so they got into a dispute. And so there was supposed to be a settlement, and I actually remember the day, August 1 of 94, and it broke down, and we were at an attorney's office. Well, I was a young CFO at the time. I guess I was 32, and so things broke down, and Herb was trying to basically, be tough with me as far as things he was looking for. So that night, I get a phone call at 1 a.m. My wife is 7 months pregnant at the time with our first child, and it's Herb on the phone.
My goodness.
And Herb, I am now seeing the wrath of Herb. And so Herb started screaming at me. My wife could hear all this, saying, David, you're a young guy. You have your whole career in front of you. If you don't do these things, then, criminal actions are going to be brought against you. You're your career is going to be ruined, this and that. So I hang up, and my wife looks at me and says, are we going to be okay? And I said, I've done nothing wrong. I certainly hope so. But that was just one interesting little story. But because I was involved in the family side, Kathy had the dealing with the lenders and all that. I had the pleasure of dealing with the family members and had a number of stories where people would look to me because as a CFO, I knew where everything was buried. Mm-hmm. So she had all the testifying on the lender side. I had the testifying on the family litigation side of things.
Wow, what a mess. So how long did you put up with that? It's the question. Yeah.
Well, what's really ironic is I stayed through the entire thing. So the fight started in 93. It didn't get resolved till 97.
Wow.
And I stayed through all of it. And then I was promoted afterwards. Our executive VP left, and I was promoted to executive VP. And so I was running the day-to-day for Ron, as well as helping him look at other investment opportunities and things like that. And so it was a good situation and a good team. So probably the next question is, why did I leave and what happened now?
Yeah, well, what was the evolution?
So it's sort of funny. I'm here now and it's calm after everything. And so one of the things Ron did was look at investing in, this was 98, 99, some like an e-commerce opportunity. He actually had a contract to buy a public wine company and wine distributor and e-commerce. And it started, in addition to the real estate, it started to give me this question myself. Did I miss out on this whole tech boom? Here I had a computer science degree and tech background. Did I miss out on something? And so in early 2000, I actually left and I went to one and then another small tech companies to say I had to try, and they didn't work. Each one I was at for a year, each one had some great people and some who went on to do some really good things, but neither company really worked out. So I did that for 2 years, and realized, you know what, I don't really want to do this. I'd like to get back into real estate.
Sure.
And so, but that was why I left. It didn't go straight from combined to Horning. I tried something else for 2 years, but I'm glad I did, even though it didn't work out. At least I know I tried it, and I know it wasn't a what if I had done this? So I'm glad I tried it.
Yeah, the tech bubble took a lot of companies down.
It did. It did, and made me appreciate real estate.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. You went through the corporate bankruptcy of combined properties and stuff and all that. So that, you know, you couldn't have gone through much worse of an environment, I don't think, than that. I mean, I remember the early 90s and mortgage banking was pretty bad. I was at the Saul Company and we almost went down as well back then, but that was earlier. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a family issue. It was really the financial markets at the time. But, you know, for you to go through what you did, I tip my hat that you're able to put yourself through that. But so then you joined Horning Brothers in 2002.
I did. I was through a recruiter, through a headhunter, and I interviewed and joined as CFO. And Joe Horning and I really bonded in the interview process. I had just had my first nonprofit role and was starting to see the importance of being involved in the community. And we really bonded over that because Joe and Lynn Horning are very committed to DC and the community. So I got the job as CFO, and Joe was already 70, I guess. And so within a year, I became president and then CEO, just because we really had a great relationship right from the beginning, and he put a lot of faith in me. So, yeah, I think I was promoted to president within about a year into the time.
So you said you met Joe at a nonprofit?
No, I met him through the recruiting process, but we sort of bonded over our discussions of work on different nonprofits.
Okay. Which ones particularly, just out of curiosity at the time?
Well, at that time, I had just been in one called NIFTY, which stood for Network for Teaching Entrepreneurship. And it went into the schools. And okay. I know with your mentoring, this went into high schools in D.C. and a few other cities in the country. And actually gave a stipend to some of the students and worked with them on how to start a small business and be an entrepreneur. And that was my first exposure. And it was actually by accident. Ron had actually donated a little bit of money to them and they invited him to an event and he couldn't go and I went. And then they asked me if I wanted to come in and talk to the students and I did. And then I became board member and then I became board chair for DC.
Well, that's great.
I really enjoyed that. But that was it at the time. And then through my role at Horning, which we'll talk about later, got a lot more involved in the community.
That's great. So you knew when you interviewed that you had a good step into probably leadership into the firm then, right?
I wasn't sure. But for me, it was my entree back into real estate. And I said, if this works out great, if it doesn't, if I'm here just a couple of years. Because some people warned me that Joe was really difficult. And I said to myself, well, I worked for Herbert Half. So when one person's difficult, and Joe ended up being a wonderful, wonderful person. And so, but somebody had actually warned me he could be difficult. And I'm like, okay, I've seen difficult. And if it works, great. And if it doesn't, I'm back in real estate and it can be a stepping stone. And 20 years later, obviously, it was a great opportunity and was an amazing experience. Mm-hmm.
So combined, obviously, is in the retail business. And Horning Brothers, at least traditionally, has been primarily multifamily, right? That's been their business.
Right.
Horning, talk about that transition for you.
Right. Horning does have some commercial and mixed use, but is primarily residential. It was an interesting transition in that I had never done residential at the time. Residential is so much more people intensive, both with your employees and with your residents. I would say that my job at Horning involved, you know, managing not just 175 employees, but working with 10,000 residents. And I'm like, okay. I wake up going, okay, what issues on the management side and with all these people and communities and all that are we looking at? So with retail, the big thing is, I mean, getting the good leases. It's not a it's not an intense property management business. It's an intense develop in the right place and get the good retail lease in place.
Well, it's obviously retailer relationships is important too. Your landlord, so you got to be strong with your retailers, you know, and treat them well to keep them. But talk about scale a little bit. So the scale of combined, you know, the size, you know, because you were the CFO, you would know the economics, the number of properties, et cetera, and then transitioning to Horning, compare the size of the two organizations then.
Sure. You know, one sort of on the commercial side, you measure more in number of shopping centers or square feet, and on
right.
the residential side,
units,
you're
typically.
More units. And so at combined, gosh, I'm trying to remember back then, I guess it was probably about 3 million square feet. I'm thinking
25, 30 shopping centers, somewhere
yeah,
in that range.
Yeah, 3 to 4 million square feet. And at Horning, it was a little over 4,000 units and about 400,000 square feet of commercial.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the scale was not too different then?
No, not too different scale-wise.
Interesting. So looking at the finance side of things, you know, the shopping center business primarily was CMBS, life companies, and banks. That would be your primary relationships, right?
That's correct.
But then on the multifamily side, you move into the Fannie and Freddie environment. Is that where you more or less focused on your financing? Or?
Fannie, Freddie, life companies, and some HUD. I mean, HUD financing, you know, you deal with the hassles of HUD, but my gosh, we closed a loan a year or two ago before rates went up at Horning, 35-year, 2.58%. Can't go too wrong with that.
Was that a 221D4?
It was a refi, so yeah, that would be new construction.
223F?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, got it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, but that takes over a year to close from what I've been
It does. It does.
Seen.
That's the thing with dealing with the timing and the challenges.
But it's worth it if you can hold out that long.
There are circumstances where it works. Yeah.
Yeah. So talk about your evolution at Horning. What did you, when you came in, what were you looking at? What were your challenges when you first came in, and then how did you get your hands around them?
So when I came in, I mean, Horning was a good, stable company, but Joe was very sort of old school. I mean, he was the founder. He wasn't that involved in worrying about back office or operations or processes or technology, and even as much on the people management. He was, I'm going to build a property and I'm going to build it at a good cost. He was his own construction superintendent.
Oh, really?
On his first project.
Well, that's interesting.
So that was his background. So I tried to create more of a culture of, you know, bringing people together, collaborating, empowering people, bringing technology forward, things like that as I was looking at that. In addition to finding ways and, you know, to still find some new projects and new opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Was it a vertically integrated company when you started, or did you make it so as you grew it up a little bit?
Actually, it was vertically integrated. We did all the property management, but one thing we actually stopped doing over time was Joe actually, in some projects, had been his own GC, and we weren't doing enough projects for that to make sense.
Mm-hmm. So you stopped construction.
Yeah, we stopped construction because we didn't have enough going on. We would, if you look at the people that like W.C. Smith and Bizzuto's and Paradigm, they do construction both for themselves and for others. You have really do enough construction to make sense.
Right, right. So scale, I mean, when you started and then as you grew over the 20-year period, how did your portfolio grow?
You know, we probably added, I mean, I'm trying to think. We were always more of a slow growth company. We didn't use other people's money. So it wasn't that we, you know, grew a huge amount. We did add some really important projects like Tivoli, which is a mixed-use project that includes a giant grocer in Columbia Heights, and Stanton Commons, which was the new Martha's Table headquarter and the housing there. And we developed a couple other projects of housing, of apartments along the way, and bought a couple along the way. There is a good portfolio there to continue to grow and to redevelop. Like the last acquisition was a 100,000 square foot warehouse.
Oh, really?
Not typical for there, but it's less than a half mile from the Largo Metro, where there's a new hospital center there. There's potential RPAI, new town center. So that could be developed into 600-700 units. So I think it continues to lay the groundwork as a generational business with ongoing opportunities.
Mm-hmm. So what was your lens for new deals there at Horning Brothers? And then we'll then move into Minkiti after that, because I assume that's, you know, you watched Bo grow with his company. So I'd like to understand kind of if you brought some of that philosophy with you from Horning Brothers to here, or what was your thought process?
Sure. I mean, Horning was definitely looking sort more conservatively. You know, they're looking at projects that, you know, would make sense from a, you know, shorter term return type of basis, you know, that, but they are willing to hold long term. But projects that are totally their own capital, you know, historically, you know, so that limits the size and scope of certain projects in today's world.
They wouldn't take a site and go sit down with another major developer like JBG or somebody like that and do a major mixed-use development together with somebody else.
No. I mean, we did Tivoli, which was a mixed-use ourselves, but because of the public-private partnership nature of it, we didn't have to put a lot of equity into that at the time.
Interesting.
We didn't have a project where we had to put, like, $20 million of equity into a project. And Joe, if you go back into his history, did a lot of HUD D4s back when you could do 100% loan to cost.
Right? Right.
So a lot of the projects were done like that over time.
Mm-hmm.
HUD has obviously changed their underwriting over time.
Yeah, I think when I was in mortgage banking, and this goes back to probably before you were there, I looked at financing the Saratoga and Chesapeake projects, which are adjacent to each other on Connecticut Avenue. And as I recall, the Chesapeake was an older project, and then he had the land next door and built the Saratoga.
That's correct.
New at the time. And this was late 80s, I think it was.
Yes, he started construction in Saratoga in 1989.
And I think, and I'm not sure, but I think Walker & Dunlop financed that with Fannie Mae at the time, if I'm not mistaken. I may not be right, but I'm just curious. Or a life company, I couldn't remember.
I think it was a life company.
At that time.
Yeah, it was before my time there, but I remember refinancing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was, Saratoga was at that time a pretty cutting edge apartment project as far as quality, and it's one of the nicer buildings, and certainly on the Connecticut Avenue corridor at the time.
It was. If you recall, D.C. did not have a lot of new development because of rent control until that ended. And then the 1980s were a tougher time with interest rates. So when that was built, 89 to the early 90s, were when the first apartments were really, the first nicer apartments were starting to get built in D.C.
That's right. Yeah. So when you took over, how much development did you guys do? You did the Tivoli project, and you mentioned a project in Southeast also.
Right. We did Tivoli. We did the project in Southeast. We did a project up in Frederick, Maryland.
Oh, really?
Yes. Okay. We had that land and had done some phases of that already, but some additional land. Those were really the three main development projects.
Mm-hmm. That we did. And what about acquisitions? Did you acquire properties?
Yeah, we did. We acquired that warehouse. We acquired a property in Silver Spring. I don't think we had a lot of other acquisitions at the time.
Mm-hmm. Did you sell real estate as well? Sell properties? Or
always a long-term hold. Always long-term hold. We did not sell.
Mm-hmm. So is Joe still with us?
Joe is 91 right now. It's
wow.
Still with us. He's not involved in the business anymore.
Does he have heirs that kind of take the business on, or what?
His children are not in real estate, but they do form a family board.
I see.
And that was one, you know, we talked a little about Kathy Bonifay before, and Kathy and I have always remained very good friends, and we had unusual positions in that non-family member CEOs sort of a family real estate business, which is an interesting position and different than a lot, because it's not always just about the real estate. There's not always a black and white line between the real estate and the other personal issues. You know, I think about estate planning and tax planning and investments and things, sort of family office type of issues as well. So mm-hmm. philanthropy and how that all ties together. So Kathy and I would talk a lot, because we'd say, you know, having a peer we can talk to about
sure.
some of the uniqueness of those kinds of positions.
So Joe would look to you more than just on the real estate side for, you know, help.
Absolutely. I was heavily involved in basically running the family office.
Interesting. So you left, and why?
So, okay. Well, about, believe it or not, I think I gave some of the longest notice of anybody. I let them know about 18 months before I left that I was going to leave, because I loved the Joe and Lynn Horning, and I wanted and have appreciated my time there. But I realized that I was coming to a period where I was ready for a change in life. I wasn't sure exactly what I would do. Initially, I thought I would probably just do some advising, but I knew I was reaching a point where I just wanted a change. So I gave them a lot of notice and working through the transition. And even today, I'm still doing some advising for them, particularly on the family office side. And so I made that decision. As I said, and didn't have plans at the time for what I would do next, and started talking to people about to start figuring that out.
And you had mentioned before we started that you did some advisory work for Bo Menchetti, and this was while you were at Horning Brothers?
Yes. So Bo actually first met Joe Horning before me, and they actually met on a nonprofit board. We hear some common themes with that. And so, we started working together with Bo on a project. And over time, I became good friends with Bo, and I had, advise him to be part of his real estate committee, his investment committee, and, mentor him on some things. And, we became, good friends, and I would, while I was at Horning, he'd be one of the people that, I would talk to, and he'd come to me with questions. And, as I said, it was on his real estate committee and advisory board.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you met him there, but maybe you can paint a little backdrop of Bo himself. I'm eventually going to interview him, I think, for the podcast, but can you give me a little bit of a Bo Menchetti story, if you can?
Yeah, Bo Menchetti is terrific. And I think he will be a great person for you to interview at some point. So Bo grew up in Boston, and he'll tell you his story a lot better than I did. And ended up coming to D.C. and initially was involved in consulting and with David Bradley and corporate executive board. But then realized he wanted to, have some other income and started to buy some individual houses. And through that, he continued to grow and realize the importance of community in doing things. And where he's really special, he has his home service side of the business, which is very unusual, the residential brokerage, the Keller Williams, the mortgage, the title, and the commercial development side of things. And Bo is one of the most amazing rainmakers I've ever met in my life, absolutely. And he cares deeply about communities and looking at opportunities for equitable development and investing in both his own projects and communities and other developers of color as he's looking at raising a fund for. So the opportunity to just work with someone like that, I think our skills complement each other really well, and we know each other better than most people who start something new. We've been friends for a long time.
What, and over 10 years?
Probably about 15.
15 years.
Yes.
So
I'm excited for when I first leaving Horning. As I said, I didn't know what I was going to do. And initially, I thought I would just advise. A lot of people said I was retiring. I never used the R word, but others used it for me. But so some people, I think, were surprised to hear. But in talking to different people about what I might do, when I started talking to Bo, we initially talked about me advising, and then as we got more engaged, realized we could accomplish a lot more together if I came in full time as president. So that was how that happened. But he's an amazing person, and I see he's accomplished a lot already, and what I think he's going to continue to accomplish is just really terrific.
So talk about the division of tasks and, you know, why you made a decision instead of being a senior advisor, which you could have been, or on his board or whatever, why you're going to take on and why you wanted to dive back into running a company and doing the day-to-day, you know, operational oversight.
Sure. As I was talking to Bo, you know, as I said, he's great at finding deals, you know, bringing in deals. You can talk about a lot of them. The phases of St. Elizabeth's right now, bond bred by that new town center at Howard University. You've got, you know, part of the yards. He's got projects up in Worcester, Mass. He's looking at this fund. But the thing that he doesn't have as much experience with, and pretty common for entrepreneurs, is execution and running a business. And that's where, you know, I come in. And so realized as an advisor, I couldn't really do that. You know, as an advisor, he'd have to hire someone who could do that. And I said, I really like what he's doing, and I would love the opportunity to get involved, because making a difference is a big part of who I'm about. And, you know, and I really see the opportunity to continue and hopefully expand the opportunities to make difference in communities, in neighborhoods, in businesses with him.
So he is in, his website's divided, I think, in four or five different operating divisions. Can you walk us through those a little bit, just at a high level, and then how you're involved in each one of them, if you can?
Sure. In simpler terms, it's really two sides, which is the residential and commercial. And commercial will include multifamily. But the residential is your typical old school, you know, brokerage. It sort of starts with the Keller Williams.
Is he a franchisee?
He has a number of franchises, not just in the D.C. region, but in other parts of the country. But through the home services, you talk about vertical integration. He also has, you know, mortgage and title and insurance and other companies in those business lines. He's got a number of different and technology business and all those things.
So are you involved in that?
Not directly. He, as an advisor, he talks to me about his investments that he makes in those, but I'm not involved in that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then he has the commercial, which is the more traditional that I think, you know, you and I are used to, which is, you know, the real estate development, management, capital raising side of things. So he's got, you know, projects that he's developing, projects that he owns. He's also, as I mentioned, the process of putting together a fund, you know, for not just his own projects, but to invest in, you know, other developers of color throughout the East Coast, and to hopefully.
Are you involved in that process?
I am involved in that process.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So pretty much everything on the commercial side I'm involved in. On the other side, I just provide some advisory services.
Does he have a management team on the other side as well?
He does.
Okay. So it's a totally separate management teams on each
it
group.
Is, yes.
Got it. Okay. So on the commercial side, he's doing development, you said. So does he have a development team for that?
Yes, he does.
Okay. And then you manage property?
We do. We still outsource some of what we have, but we're hoping at some point as we scale and grow.
Commercial and residential management, or just
right.
Residential?
We own some residential, but for now we're outsourcing the residential. So we're just managing the commercial.
Got it. And what's the portfolio right now?
It's, you know, it's not, you know, the pipeline is about 2.8 million square feet.
Wow.
So it's a big pipeline.
Development or
development?
Just development.
Just development pipeline. You know, the existing, you know, is actually smaller than the pipeline. So,
wow.
You know, when you look at the projects that are coming down the pipe.
So no wonder he needed help.
You know, exactly.
I got it.
So, you know, he went from owning a lot of small properties, which we still have, to now doing much bigger projects scale-wise.
So what gave him the impetus to put on the gas to do that?
Bo has always had a lot of ambition in terms of doing more. And so I think he started, getting involved in some bigger projects potentially as a limited partner or an investor. And then he realized, he wanted to take the lead in these. And as I said, he wanted to do that. The tagline for the company is transforming lives, career, and communities through real estate. So to do that, you need to take on a lot. I mean, that's a big, bold statement. So you need to be able to take on a lot of projects and projects in neighborhoods that, that's why there's some public-private partnerships. That's why there's some in neighborhoods where he's an early adopter of, projects where, that may have been underserved neighborhoods. I think that's important. Mm-hmm.
So how are you growing the company? I mean, you've got 2.7 million square feet to develop. So are you going to be hiring a lot of people? I mean, how are you going to gear all this stuff up?
It's a good question. A lot depends on, when they come in and how the existing team. I mean, we do have a development team already, but a lot, whether it needs more people, a lot depends on timing of when projects hit. Maybe we'll have to look at where we have partner relations. I think there's still some things to work through as we do our growth plan.
Mm-hmm. Well, the capital markets right now are not exactly favorable for ground-up development. So is this causing a little bit of concern as far as, keeping things going as far as that goes?
Or I think obviously for anybody who says no isn't really looking at the markets, but I think what it involves, and I think one of the areas the company is strong with, is creativity in financing, And so not just traditional debt, but looking at new market tax credits, looking at OZ funds, looking at where there's grants, looking at public-private. So trying to put together a capital stack that, is creative, because there are gaps that might not have been there
right
2 years ago. So, but finding ways, historic tax credits for some of the buildings up in Worcester, Mass. So just, the capital stacks are much more complex than they used to be. But, and it's certainly, by the day, sometimes those gaps change and figuring that out. So I think, the financing side becomes very critical to the whole thought process here and how to put that together. And I think that's something that the team here is good at.
Mm-hmm. Well, your background is that. So, and I'm sure you've explored a lot of those different avenues already. Even at Horning Brothers, you did a few of those things.
We did. We did a number of new market tax credit deals, a number of LIHTC deals. We did public-private deal. We did properties where you do a ground lease, so you may have less equity up front, where you're doing a public-private partnership. So, yeah, it's something I do enjoy, the financial analytical. It's like solving the problem, and a problem with the capital stack and how you can put that together.
Yeah. So looking at deals, what are the most challenging ones that you're focused on right now, trying to get something going?
There's a number of projects here that are pretty active. In D.C., we have a bond bread project with Howard University, the new town center there. So that's moving forward. We were just selected for St. Elizabeth Parcel 7, 8, and 9.
So stop a minute. Bond bread, talk about the financing of that. How's that deal?
Well, that one, we're not at the financing stage yet. So
okay,
that's
what are you thinking about as far as that goes?
That one is going to be probably a more traditional debt and equity with, potentially the opportunity.
Is that a ground lease deal with Howard?
It is, yes.
Okay, so you're going to be a leasehold position.
Mm-hmm.
And so in essence, are they a partner in the deal as well, or are they just a landowner?
Just the land.
Okay, so you have to go and do it.
Yeah.
With George Washington University, sometimes it's a little more hybrid than that if you're there on that campus, but Howard is just the land. So, and what is that? Is that a residential project?
It's mostly residential. There is going to be a hotel.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting. And you have a flag yet for the hotel?
We have somebody we're working with.
Oh, good. So is this more student housing, or is it just general
market rate
market rate housing.
Some students will live there, but it's market
rate. It's on the campus though, right? Or adjacent?
Adjacent. If you think of like where some of JBG's projects are over there in Shaw.
Well, I would think the hotel being on a university campus would be needed. Is there already a hotel in at Howard or not?
I'm not sure.
Or would this be the first one?
I think it's sort of the first brand name one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hotel financing is an interesting challenge today. Have you talked to some lenders there or not? Yeah.
I mean, I think our potential partner will be more involved in that.
Oh, so you're going to have an operating partner there?
Yeah.
Ah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So you're going to have a hotel development partner?
Most likely.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. That's good. So then you have an in-house leasing capability for residential, or would you outsource that for an apartment project?
Right now, we're outsourcing. You know, by the time that comes online and we start having more scale, we'll, you know, reevaluate. But right now, it would be outsourced.
Mm-hmm. And then I interrupted you, so you were about to talk about your next project. So.
Yeah, well, we're finishing, you know, we did MLK Gateway 1, which was, you know, the first deal at MLK in Good Hope, and now finishing MLK Gateway 2, which is going to be the new DHCD headquarters. So that's going to wrap up later this year.
And what's the mix there?
Mainly office, but governmental office over retail. Then there's going to be, we're just selected for the St. Elizabeth Parcel 789. So that's new right now. And that's going to be affordable housing with retail, with the Department of Behavioral Health moving their headquarters.
Are you on your own there, or are you in partnership with Red Brick or any of the people there or not?
We have some smaller partners, but we're the lead partner. We're not involved.
Because Red Brick has another site there, right?
Red Brick has some significant projects over in that area.
Okay. So would you say you're teaming up with smaller partners? Are you looking to form partnerships with larger developers and looking at larger scale projects?
I mean, in some cases, I mean, that was more a model of the past. I think we're moving to a stage now where we're more capable of leading things ourselves.
Interesting.
But there were ones in the past, for example, on phases of the yards that hasn't been done yet, where partners, it was originally Forest City, but now Brookfield.
Right.
And, you know, we're the smaller partner in that. But I think in, you know, other projects as we're moving forward, we will still look at ones where it's with somebody like that at Brookfield. But I think in more cases now, I think we have capacity to be the lead.
Mm-hmm. So you said you're raising a fund. Talk about that a little bit.
I can't get into a lot yet on it, but the idea is basically to, you know, raise a fund and to both for some of our own projects, but also to invest in other developers of color throughout the East Coast. There was just a New York Times article 2 weeks ago about how small a percentage of real estate is owned by, you know, people of color, commercial real estate throughout the country, and the gap on it. And actually, we had worked with some of the research firms that were behind some of the research for that New York Times article. And so we're looking at ways, and we've been talking to different developers in some different cities about ways to partner with them and to invest in them and see an opportunity for us as both an investor and partner in these, you know, opportunities.
Mm-hmm. So two guests of mine ago was, well, actually the one that's current out, and I'm about to release a new episode this week with Todd Rich, but before that, I had Catherine Buell on, and of course, they've invested over $1 billion now in Amazon into affordable housing. Are you involved at all with Amazon? Have you talked to them about any of your projects?
So it's interesting because Amazon's very first deal was with the Washington Housing Conservancy, which I was chair of the board. And so I actually worked with them through their first deal here before it was even public. It's fun. We had to keep everything confidential. So it was a really good process working with Catherine and the team over there at Amazon. So, you know, so we have, you know, they definitely can play a role in potentially filling certain aspects of the capital stack and financing in certain deals. I mean, we're going into some cities or some areas where they may not be investing, but I've done a lot of work with Amazon and a number of discussions. Washington Housing Conservancy has done two deals with them. I've been a mentor through their program. They've partnered with Capital Impact for with a program, an equitable developer program, and providing some seed capital to some investors. So I've done a lot of work with that program through Capital Impact as well. So I think there will be opportunities. We stay in touch with Catherine. There may be opportunities where they fund aspects of deals that we're looking at. Mm-hmm.
So the equity you're going to raise is more at the LP level?
That's correct.
Limited partnership?
Yeah.
You're not going to be at like at a general partner level and take promotes and that kind of thing? It's more at the LP level mostly?
It's mostly at the LP in some of the deals, but in some deals we are going to be a lead and more active in the GP and take promote. So I think we're looking at both types of deals in different situations.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So you mentioned, and I didn't get into this with you, but you said you were chair of the Washington Housing Conservancy. So was that while you were in Horning Brothers, obviously. So how did that happen? And what other roles like that did you take on while you were at Horning Brothers?
I've been very involved in a number of nonprofits. Being involved in the community is very important to me.
Sure.
And the areas that I'm most focused are housing, community, I'll use that broadly, and mentoring. So, I don't see it as a separate thing, like a bigger workload. I see it as part of my role. You know, it was part of my role at Horning. It helped me, work through, one, I would learn from others being involved in these things. There are great people involved. Number two, improving our communities would improve, my work at Horning. It also, improving our communities, just help overall, and the relationships that I've built. So, long way of saying, I've been involved in a number. So, currently, the Washington Housing Conservancy, I just stepped down as chair after 3.5 years. I'm still on the board and real estate committee. But I'm really proud from the time I was chair, we went from 0 units to 1,500 units.
So, how did you get involved in that originally?
Yeah, how I got involved in that initially is, I think a couple people on the board, I think some of the early people involved, obviously JBG was involved and Josh Bernstein and AJ Jackson of JBG, they came to me, they knew about my work at Horning, my work at other community focus. They also toured our Stanton project, which was an amazing project for Ward 8 and providing community services there, bringing Martha's Table there. And they came to me and initially asked if I wanted to be on the board. And then after I said yes, they're like, do you want to chair this? we need a chair. Anthony Williams has been, interim chair, but we need a chair. And I said, sure, it sounds like a good thing because I have a passion for housing and I see housing affordability as such a critical issue. And it's been so siloed between for-profit and nonprofit and government and philanthropy. I saw what the Housing Conservancy and the Housing Initiative doing as an opportunity to start trying to bring some of that together, in some of the tools that they were using to be more effective. And I think the evidence is going from 0 units to 1,500 in a couple years. When you see a lot of these nonprofits, aren't even that big after decades, they're just developing a little bit. Now, this is preservation versus development, but I was excited by the model and excited about the work that the Conservancy did.
So what was the original mission of the Washington Housing Conservancy?
It was basically preserving workforce housing in the path of growth.
In the district itself?
In the D.C. region, at least 50% being in D.C. itself, but the others in Maryland and Virginia. Mm-hmm. Like the first acquisition with Amazon was actually right by their headquarters in Crystal City. So, we know rents were going to go up there. So the ability to preserve and restrict rent growth long term there was going to be really important. So that was something that, was worked on. So that's the role at the Conservancy. Let's see, other roles, I've been on the board of Wesley Housing, which is more of a traditional affordable housing tax credit developer. And so I've been really impressed with their work, mostly Virginia, but they've come into D.C. on the board.
That's a religious group, isn't it? No. Wesley Housing? No, it isn't.
They've done a number of projects partnering with churches on their land.
Okay.
But no, they're pure.
They're a nonprofit.
They're a nonprofit affordable, traditional tax credit affordable housing provider.
Okay.
I think they do a nice job. I'm on the board of Martha's Table. We did their new headquarters in Ward 8, and that project, which has just made such a difference in that community and neighborhood, and I've been really actively involved on an ongoing basis with them and excited about their work, particularly transitioning from, you know, what people think of Martha's Table as the food distribution or early childhood, to more of a place-based model, which is where you're working with the community and the community needs and defining that.
How does Martha's Table complement like DC Kitchens and some of the other, I mean, talk about that a little bit and how they break that out a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think DC Kitchen does a lot more on the pure food side than Martha's Table. I mean, Martha's Table has, you know, has a food delivery for the homeless, but it's also has where people can come in and get, you know, they have a lobby market where people can come in and get healthy food. I think there's enough need. There's not a competition amongst that. And I think DC Food Central Kitchen is all about food. And Martha's Table, it's one piece of the puzzle of serving a community mm-hmm. in need and
yeah.
looking at the holistic approach to that.
Interesting.
And then, let's see, my other current board is Greater Washington Community Foundation, which I really have appreciated because they look at more of a broader approach to look how to look at issues in the city. And so that's, you know, really appreciate the work that they've done, especially through COVID and supporting a lot of organizations with that. And I was involved in chairing their Partnership to End Homelessness Committee for a bit. So those are my current lives, but I'm always like, I find that, you know, being involved is in the community is just in really important both for the work that's being done. And I don't look at it as an extra thing outside of my job. I look at it as part of it, and it helps me, you know, it's, you know, me benefiting them with my knowledge, but me benefiting, I'm learning from each of these organizations and I'm meeting great people and mm-hmm. I'm being involved. Earlier, I had been on the advisory committee for the Housing Production Trust Fund for DC, which gave me good insights to how they were putting out some funds for that. So that gave me the governmental.
When were you there?
I think my last year on that probably was a year before COVID. So probably through 20 or 21.
Okay. I mean, so you were there after Catherine Buell was on it then.
Yeah.
She was on that board.
Yeah, I was after that. Uh-huh. So those are some of the different roles that I'm involved in.
So were any of those, did you start any of those, or are they all that you were joined after they were already formed in each one, each case?
They were all ones that, well, the Housing Conservancy had just started. It didn't have any units yet, but it had been formed, so
right.
it was early. Right. And then Martha's Table, obviously, had been around a long time, but I got on the board and, you know, the Hornings made a generous grant, Joel and Horning, and we developed that new community serving project in Ward 8 for them. So it was there as they sort of transitioned their whole model of what they were doing.
Interesting. So what, if you look at your day, what percentage of your time do you focus on your nonprofit activities as well as your, now maybe that's changed since you've come over to Mankiti as opposed to when you were at Horning Brothers, but how do you see that as far as allocation of time?
I mean, it was mostly always Horning, but I would, you know, as we all know, it's not a 40-hour week. I find the time, like Wesley Housing Board meetings were at
in
night.
In the evening?
Yeah, yeah, were at night.
Sure.
At Martha's Table, I would go over for a day board meeting, but we were developing the housing project next door, so I would tie the time
right.
together
right,
and
exactly.
things like that. So, I don't know. I mean, it was still mostly, you know, almost, you know, heavily Horning, but I would just find the time. My kids are grown. I would find the time to work on these other initiatives. And I think it's important to be part of, you know, making a difference, you know, in our communities. And so that's just part of, you know, what I see as our role and responsibility and what I, you know, want to be doing.
Mm-hmm. So you said that you think there's a tremendous opportunity here, which is exciting for you. So what do you see as the difference between the culture here as opposed to where you were at Horning Brothers? And what are you trying to bring here other than just, it sounds like you want to bring a, you know, a little bit more structure, help with the growth process. What, talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, Horning, I mean, 80 to 90% of the employees, 80 plus percent of the employees were property management. I mean, we have people out at all the properties.
Sure, and, right.
You know, I mean, and working with that. And so it's very decentralized with that. And so it was very, you know, intensive as far as out, you know, understanding, you know, the issues that people dealt with on site. It was much more, you know, it was really about people. I mean, it really, really was about people. And you know, one of our core values was community focus. And I define community as meaning our employees, our residents, our vendors, and our communities around us. And mm-hmm. so, you know, here, community is critical. I mean, it's in our tagline, you know, transforming communities, you know. But for where we are at this stage, it's definitely much more about finding new opportunities and, you know, the development side and putting in place the execution. I mean, Horning, with the number of units, you know, had more in place. So there's more that has to be put in place here as far as processes and execution.
Mm-hmm. So as you're looking for employees, what are you looking for?
You know, we're looking for people who want to, you know, make a difference, you know, beyond just the day-to-day real estate. People who are driven, you know, people who are, you know, people who want, you know, are willing to work hard, people who are excited about, like, trying to make a difference in communities. If you just want to make, you know, we're profit-focused, but we want to do more than that. It's sort of double bottom line, you know, people overuse the term. But if you're just looking to make the best profit and do a Class A apartment building in downtown DC, you know, we're not the right fit. If you want to, like, make a difference in, you want to make a profit, but you want to make a difference in communities, you know, we're a fit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What about the environment? Are you pretty focused at all on that? ESG?
We think of our fund as an example, as an impact fund. We're looking at impact, you know, on neighborhoods. It may not be pure, like the E, a lot of people jump to the environmental side of ESG, but we look at measuring impact and impact in terms of income of people in the community, of jobs, of businesses, of things like that, you know, so that, you know, impact on, you know, the equitable development side and investing in underserved neighborhoods and underserved businesses. So that side we very much are, you know. So as I said, people often jump to the E in the environmental and ESG, but I think we're heavily focused on impact. But, you know, some of the other, you know, aspects of that are the bigger focus for us.
So going through your career, and then thinking back at Combined Properties, there weren't probably very many minorities that were working at that firm at the time when you worked there. And then over time, obviously, working in the city and focused on that, it's obviously a much more diverse environment. Talk about the difference between working at a company that is not diverse vis-a-vis a company that's diverse and why it's important to work in a company with diversity.
Sure. And I mean, if you look at, you're accurate about Combined. I mean, if you look at Horning was probably, you know, more than 80% minority employees, and, you know, Mankiti is minority owned. So I think it's important to really, you know, you get the diverse views. People talk about DEI and diverse views as important, but it's also important for people to know, you know, no matter who they are, you know, that you care. I mean, I think one of the big things at Horning that people really respected me for was, you know, my caring and my level of having people's backs. And so, you know, people would deal with some difficult situations with residents or with agency. And I'd go out personally and, you know, to work with people through situations and developing the relationships. And one of our managers would joke, property managers, she would try to solve a problem and nobody would respond to her. But then when I got involved, you know, people responded immediately. It's like, well, that was, you know, relationship building. And, you know, having people in the city who knew who I was and being able to call on them. So I think that, you know, you clearly, you know, everybody talked about the diverse points of view. And I think that's important. And I think especially in the different communities and neighborhoods that we're trying to work in, it's important that people, you know, feel that the people working with them and the real estate people coming in, you know, represent the communities that they're going into. I think that's a very important aspect of it when you go to community meetings and, you know, that people, you know, see that.
Another person I interviewed has a very similar perspective that you have, which is interesting. And listening to what you've said, and I don't, you probably know her. It's Vicki Davis with Urban Atlantic.
I don't know her well, but I know Vicki.
Their company is very similar to what you're trying to accomplish here, and where they look at public-private partnerships and trying to solve community issues, looking at the Parks of Walter Reed project particularly.
Right. And the word solve is probably too strong. I mean, we want, nobody's trying to go in and solve somebody else's issues. You know, we want to be part of working with communities. And I think that's important. And I think that, you know, I think that, you know, I think the approach is important. So, and not as an outsider coming in and trying to solve, but as somebody trying to work with communities and with people in the communities.
So let's go to some of your personal choices. You've already talked a lot about your passion for giving back and the community involvement. Talk about your family and the priorities of family work and giving back.
Sure. One of the things I'm really proud of is I think, you know, my family and, you know, my two kids have terrific values. They're both very good people. So, you know, my wife, Nancy, and I have been married for 30 years, and we have two children, Benjamin, who's 28, and he actually works at Freddie Mac on the tech side, and my daughter, Madeline, works for a nonprofit in New York. And I think that family is very important to us. I think values and giving back are important. We actually worked with our kids. We didn't keep it going, but founded a small nonprofit when they were in high school called Reboot, Reuse, Rebuild that basically refurbished old computers and donated to learning centers.
Oh, that's great.
To teach them early about the importance of being involved in things.
So you couldn't keep your hands off computers,
I mean,
could you?
I couldn't keep my hands off computers. And it's, you know, I mean, it's, look, philanthropy is great and giving money is great. But I think, you know, being more hands-on is important and not looking at it as like, I want to make money and then if I do well, I'm willing to give back. But to make it part of the mindset of your day-to-day life. And, you know, and that's how the companies at Horning and, you know, at Mankiti, you know, we look at life. So I'm really proud that, you know, the family's good. You know, they have wonderful values. And we also, we love, you know, our passions are, you know, we're foodies. We love our food and we love our travel. So that's, you know, what we tend to do and as a family, and I'm very proud of everybody.
Well, when you started your real estate career, you worked for one of the toughest guys in the industry who wasn't really well known, I don't believe, for philanthropy at all. I mean, he was a tough guy that was hard and difficult. Maybe he was a philanthropist to some extent. I don't know. But I, of course, interviewed Gary Rappaport, who was his son-in-law. And he made it very clear that he said it's more important to be a good man than to be a good businessman. It strikes me that your experience with the Half family maybe reinstilled that thought process with you a little bit, perhaps?
Yeah, I think a big part of it, absolutely. And I think, you know, a big part, you know, working at Horning has been terrific. And Joe and Lynn Horning are amazing people. And one of the things I can say that I don't think people can often say is working at Horning made me a better person.
Well, that's great.
So I don't know that you can always say that, so that I became a better person there. And I think, you know, being around, I had touched on some of this community stuff and philanthropy before that. But for Joe and Lynn Horning and their family,
it's a priority.
I mean, that's a priority for them, and in so much of what they do. And Joe and Lynn Horning were like parents to me. And I'm like the same age as their oldest child. And I just, what they accomplished and who they are as people and the values that they instill. And I was able to take what I saw from that and learned from that and to expand on that and bring it into my own life. And, you know, I think that they played a big role in that as well. And really, I don't know if I would have grown like that without that aspect of learning. Because there's aspects to, you know, there's sort of things like, okay, I want to do good. But then you start learning about ways of doing it and ways of incorporating it into life.
Yeah. You and I also served on the UL Advisory Board for many years together and still do, actually, to some extent. I think you're still involved in the Advisory Board. Talk about the ULI influence.
Sure. I mean, ULI is a great organization. I think it brings together people in real estate, both locally and nationally. I never got as involved nationally, but locally. One of the big things I've learned in my career is the importance of relationships. And it wasn't something I focused on as much early. And you find great people to be able to talk to and to be peers with and to learn from and people to do business with. I found business opportunities through it. And so I think being involved with the people in that has been really good. It provided the opportunity. I mentored a number of years, which you did even more, the Young Leader Program. I love to be a mentor. You know, that's something I've done. I helped create the capstone class at University of Maryland's Master's in Real Estate program when it first started. Mm-hmm. And was involved in mentoring people and actually taught there for a number of years. And as I mentioned, I'm now mentoring through the Capital Impact Amazon program. So I think the ability to mentor is another way of giving back. And I think it's great, the different programs that ULI has. So it was, you know, it's been a really great opportunity. I haven't been as involved in that recently. As you can see, I have some other organizations I've been involved
yes,
in.
Yes, you sure have.
I have a lot of great people that became relationships through it.
Well, I say it is, in my mind, it's the leading organization in real estate, to be honest with you, but that's just my opinion. So let's talk about life, about your biggest wins, losses, and most surprising events, David, in your career.
Gosh, okay. There are probably a few different ways of looking at wins, and how do I look at that? I'd probably say, you know, there are a couple projects that stand out. And we had two projects at Horning during my time there that won the Washington Business Journal Community Impact Award. I think given the importance of real estate being more than just building buildings, but part of communities, to actually deliver on that with Tivoli and Stanton Commons, I think I'm really, you know, excited about. I think that was a win. I think the role at Washington Housing Conservancy, seeing it go from zero units to 1,500. And we're hoping that that becomes a model that's scalable and replicable because there's such a need on housing issues in mm-hmm. our country. So I think those are some of the biggest wins from a business standpoint. Obviously, from a personal standpoint, family, I'm thrilled at where my family is right now mm-hmm. and proud of everybody. Losses, it's hard to say because, you know, even things that fail, sometimes you learn from and you grow from. We talked about my initial interview experience and my failing at going tech, but I'm happy with where things ended up. But, you know, a few specific projects. We had a project we partnered with Bo a block from here that became famous, the 901 Monroe project that became the project everybody talked about. It was the first project that got overturned on appeal by, you know, the appeals court after the zoning commission and set a precedent in the city that caused a lot of problems to get projects done. And it still has never gotten done. It's still sitting there, right, hoping it can get done now. So, you know, that was disappointing, you know. And
that was a joint venture with Horning and McKitty?
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
You know, and so, I mean, that was a lot. I mean, obviously, you know, the Haft family and seeing, you know, the personal and family fight side of thing is, you know, was a loss because, you know, the business and the family had a lot of good things going, and to see that come apart. And
I mean, the retail properties were all pretty good.
Yeah, they were. So that's probably the losses. Surprising, I think, that, you know, so much of where I am now has been driven by, you know, building relationships and community and things like that. And here we talked about how I graduated business school and couldn't carry on enough of a conversation to get a job, but that it's important that people always focus on growing technical skills over time, but sometimes it's just as important to grow the people skills. So I think it's surprising that, you know, that was where I was able to grow and to make a difference, you know, and I think that's probably, you know, the biggest surprise, that I'm here because of the less technical side of the job.
So I'm sure the next question that I ask you is, you're going to basically reiterate what you just said. What advice would you give your 25-year-old self?
I think you're right. I think the side of the importance of relationship building. So much, I mean, of opportunities that have come my way have become relationships. Even being here today with Bo Mankiti was a relationship that I had worked on and developed over time. That when I was young, I thought being smart was enough. And then you realize that it's relationships. You talked about your role at ULI, and you think about all the people you met through that and how that's provided all the opportunities. But when you're young, you don't necessarily realize that. But the earlier that you can realize that in the relationship. And I also say getting involved on the community nonprofit side, because it provides a lot of opportunities. You know, you think about the good you're doing, but it's also, I say it's selfish and selfless. Because the selfish side, the selfless, you're doing something good. The selfish side, you know, you're meeting a lot of great people that will become opportunities. It feels good to do something good. And you're building a lot of great relationships. I talked about how Bo and Joe Horning met on a nonprofit board. I have people that I've done business with through meeting on nonprofit boards. So I would say that, you know, those would be the messages I would tell my 25-year-old. Thankfully, I didn't wait so long to learn that. I learned it, you know, as time went by. But the earlier you can learn that, the better.
So if you could post a statement on a billboard on the Capitol Beltway for millions to see, what would it say, David?
So I'm going to do two. I'm going to cheat because there's two that I'd like to do. So the first one, at a mentor meeting for the Amazon Capital Impact Fund, they went around the room, this is spur of the moment, and asked, if somebody's writing your biography, whatever number of years from now, what would they title it? And I said something off the cuff, and I'm still happy with it, which is pretty good. And it was making a difference in small ways. So I could say, for a billboard, for others, make a difference in small ways. I know we're not all going to change the world, but if everybody tries to make a difference in small ways, I think it would make things a lot better. So that would be
That's the first one.
And I still remember going around that room. That was on the spot, and I'm happy with that. And then the other one, just because I have to add a second one, I still consider myself a bit of a nerd. You know, it's always, you know, always be open to learning, you know, so it doesn't matter what age we are, whether we're, you know, an entry level person or a CEO, that you always, there's things you can always learn. And so, and it's important to think of things that way. And I'm always, when I'm around other people, thinking of having people that I can learn from.
Anything else you'd like to say, David?
Well, I really very much appreciate the time. I'm excited and appreciate you doing these podcasts, John, and I've had the opportunity to listen to a number of them, and I'm hoping that people get a chance to learn a little bit about, you know, careers and can think about things for themselves as they grow. So thank you.
Well, thank you very much, David. I appreciate your time very much. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
So we just listened to David Rudberg of the Mankiti Group, and good
a good discussion about an interesting evolution of his career over many, many times. I met him three lives ago, basically, when he was at Combined Properties, and he's had made two major shifts since then, but obviously spent the most time at Horning Brothers. So as I usually do, I'm bringing on my Postscript associate today, and today it's Kevin Dean. Kevin, welcome. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, John. Excited to talk a bit about the podcast and a little bit about David's story.
That's great. So what was, at a high level, what was your impression?
Yeah, very impressed by just David's story and his career, and interesting to just think about the progression from when he was, you know, young and fresh in the industry to where he is today, where he's kind of, you know, co-leading the Menchiti Group as president. And it's also interesting just to consider the fact that it seems to me to be rare that you have a president who's, you know, serving in that position alongside the founder and the CEO, and they're both active in the business. So I think it's pretty cool setup and place that he's put himself in today. So excited to kind of get into it and hear your thoughts as well. Kind of where I thought we could start maybe was kind of going back to just the beginning of David's career and his time that he spent with Herbert Half and the combined companies. So I'm curious just what your thoughts were on his experience there, and also just maybe the impact that experience had on the way that he views partnerships, business, relationships, and kind of how it maybe affected the rest of his career.
Well, what we did talk quite a bit about that, because when I moved to Washington in the late 80s, Herbert Half was actually very actively in the news. He at one point tried to buy Safeway by doing, as you may recall, I don't know if you were too young to know this, but we had this time when people were using what was known as green mail to basically using debt to buy public companies. And there were several, you know, corporate raiders that were out there, and Haft wanted to play that way using his company, Dark Drug, which he had built in the 60s and 70s. As a, you know, discount retailer. He then hired investment bankers to help him try to acquire retailers and do other things. And he started a couple of companies called Crown Books and Track Auto. And he was pretty active in the Shoppers Food Warehouses growth here, as well as the Dark Drug, which was his original enterprise. So he was an interesting character and had a reputation, as David referred to in the podcast, as being very tough negotiator, difficult. So, you know, his time there, he started as a junior analyst, but grew pretty quickly in there because a lot of the people above him just left and couldn't put up with the Haft family issues because they're a difficult family to work with. But, you know, I have to hand it to Herb's son, Ron, who has kept the company going and running and still running and running well, although he's more the chairman now, and he's hired adequate and more than adequate leadership to keep the company sustained after the family dispute in the 90s.
Yeah. And, you know, on the flip side, it sounds like his experience with Horning Brothers was very different from the experience that he had at Combined Properties. He did have an interesting sort of time in between that I'm curious if you had any takeaways from it. There was a time where he left Combined and it was kind of during the dot-com bubble between 2000 and 2002. And, you know, he decided he wanted to maybe try more of his entrepreneurial side and, you know, see if he could try his hand out in the tech sector during that dot-com boom. Curious, any takeaways just on the fact that he left, you know, kind of a lofty position with Combined doing one thing and then made a complete switch of industries. Any takeaways there?
Yeah, well, if you may recall, when he was at Duke, his undergraduate major was computer science. Mm-hmm. So he had an interest in the tech industry early on. He started at pre-med, and then he pivoted into technology. And then he went immediately to the University of Michigan's graduate business school because he wasn't ready to go out into the working world at the time, and continued to have interest in tech, even though he was more of a finance guy and learned the finance side when he was there and the numbers, but still had a, an interest in the technology side and applied to 11 firms in Silicon Valley and, you know, in the technology, and got zero job offers in that. So it disappointed him. And he went back and did Dale Carnegie and all kinds of things to deal with lead. And then went into two other things, went into banking and other things before he joined Combined Properties in real estate. And that was really incidental. Real estate really wasn't interested in his, except he was just referred to it and joined it. So it kind of came at it kind of, incidentally, whereas tech was something that was always in his blood that he was curious about. And then suddenly that opportunity came when Ron Haft was investing in tech companies. He said, ooh, here's my opportunity maybe to do something in it. So he decided to take a leap. And so that's probably what drove him to do it.
Right. To me, it was interesting just because you think about, you know, if you're younger in your career, the path that you hope you'll take in your career.
Yeah.
And, you know, you often have an idea of where you'll go and what you'll do. But I just thought it was a good story that kind of highlighted the fact that you really don't know where you're going to end up, how you're going to get there, what's going to happen in the meantime. It's just interesting.
You don't.
If you think about, you know, if that had worked out and say he had gone and worked with a company that became, you know, the next tech unicorn, you know, his life would have looked a lot different.
It's funny how one phone call, one meeting, one chanced conversation can change your life. You know, it's just incredible when I think back of my life, how one phone call, one luncheon, one meeting, and somebody says, "Would you might be interested in this maybe, or could this interest you? Let's talk." And you have a conversation. Oh yeah, this is really interesting. And then it just keeps going from there.
Right. And then you'll end up somewhere you never thought you would have been to start
with. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And honestly, it sounds like that's kind of how he ended up with Menkiti, with the Menkiti Group, because he had run into Bo, you know, over the years working while he was still working with Horning.
Yeah.
But before we get to his kind of experience, you know, where he's at now with the Menkiti Group and, you know, maybe what that company looks like. It sounds like his he really enjoyed his time at Horning Brothers.
Yes.
And not only did he learn a ton, experience a lot, you know, do a lot of really interesting projects and work with a lot of interesting people, but he also enjoyed his time there. He was able to kind of balance life and work.
Yes.
And he's been an integral part of his community. What were your just general takeaways with his experience at Horning Brothers and kind of the way that he, you know, led that, you know, company and fulfilled his role there?
Well, when he met Joe, and it was basically just a recruiting thing, he was introduced to him. He found out there was a common bond right up front in the nonprofit space and doing, you know, giving back to the community and getting involved there, because he had been in a nonprofit himself and got a lot out of it. And so that bond really grew, I think. And that's what integrated the idea of giving back to the community as well as doing business in the community. So that kind of that shared, you know, taking and giving to the community from the community and then giving back to the community really came from working with Joe and his philosophy and things. So part of that giving to the community was meeting people like Bo Menkiti, or were coming up in the industry, you know, primarily as Washington, D.C. is predominantly African-American at that time. We would find young entrepreneurs that were trying to make a statement and try and make things happen in, you know, the underserved areas of the city and things like this, because Joe had a, you know, a passion to help. And so, you know, David followed through with that. And so that was integrated into that company. Joe did not want to go outside the company to raise equity to try to grow the firm. He wasn't as driven to be a big player in the market. He wanted to do his own thing. He wanted to build his own, didn't want to find partnerships to grow the company per se. So they were relatively slow growth, is what David said. And so he only cited like two or three large projects, which took some time, each one of them. but he wasn't doing four or five projects at the same time, like some of the large developers in the city. You know, he wasn't going to be JBG. He wasn't going to be, you know, MRP or any of the major big companies. He was going to be, you know, more of a quiet family-run operation. And Joe was in his 70s when David came on board. So he was already pretty much at the end of his active career, as David took over a year later. But the philosophy of the company wasn't to, you know, grow big. And that was suited David fine. And it got him involved in the community more. So it gave him time to do more things in the community.
Right. And on the flip side, it sounds like he's now moving to, you know, despite, you know, being more experienced in his career, actually going in a different direction where he's getting involved with a group that seems, at least from the outside, to be a pretty quick, you know, fast growing company. I think at one point David described Bo, who's the founder of the Minkiti Group, as like a serial entrepreneur almost.
That's right.
Lots of different lines of business. So I don't know. To me, it just seems like a really interesting partnership and relationship between David and Bo, where he's coming in as president. He's bringing tons of experience. And Bo's also got tons of opportunities, a full pipeline, and a lot of ideas. So it seems like they're primed for growth, a very interesting pivot in David's career.
Well, David knew him for 15 years before he joined him. So he saw the growth, and he saw it as being, you know, as he said right up front, Bo is one of the most amazing rainmakers he's ever seen, ever met. So his strength was bringing in new business, getting things started. A serial entrepreneur is what he said. And David's strength is operations, the day-to-day operations, you know, being the Mr. Inside guy, you know, running the company, getting it, you know, managed, setting up systems, getting things organized, you know, as I like to call it in our industry. And there's basically two functions. That's all there is. There's hunting and skinning. So hunting is finding deals, and skinning is making them work, making it happen, getting it underwritten, getting it operated, running day to day. That's David's strength. He's a skinner. So you've got the two elements you need to run a successful enterprise in real estate: hunting and skinning. It's that simple.
I haven't
heard simple.
The hunting and the skinning analogy. I've heard hunter and the hammer, but I might have to start using that one. I like it.
Yeah.
So, you know, with all that said, I think kind of the theme that I noticed that runs through David's career, and I think you even asked him at one point, what is the best advice that he would give himself? And you know, it sounds like the thing that's really made him successful is his ability to build relationships. And I think real estate is a relationship business. So it makes sense that serves him well at, you know, up until this point in his career. But I'm curious, just to take it in a little bit of a different direction. It seems like real estate is becoming increasingly transactional. You know, there's more liquidity out there, there's more data available. And, you know, we've talked in the past about how real estate is becoming more like a bond, essentially, than it is just a real estate asset. Curious, what do you think about the fact that real estate is changing in that way? Do you think relationships will still be, you know, the key to success in this business, or one of the key factors? Do you see that changing at all?
Well, it's changing, but not the way you're directing it. I think the relationships will become even more important going forward in the way that people haven't seen before. So let me try to translate the right way. Real estate is becoming even more experiential now than it ever has been. So if to be successful in real estate, you've got to have a reason for it to exist. You can't just put things up and they will come anymore. It's just not going to work. You know, the regional mall developers built regional malls because people needed to shop and would spend all day inside the center to shop. That's not the case anymore. They can do that all online. So there's no reason to even have one anymore, except for essentials, you know, I mean, you can shop for groceries online now. You don't even have to go to a grocery store anymore. So, you know, if you're interactions with human beings are a lifeblood, I think, of having real estate. If you don't have that, why even build anything? Why have real estate at all if you didn't have human interaction for it and the experience? So to me, the experience of being there physically is the important part. And that's what relationships are. I mean, the future of office buildings is such that you've got to have a reason to have it there and for people to convene and be there physically. Otherwise, there's no need for it. You know, you could do everything online. So to me, in the past, you know, the old boy network relationships, good old boy network, you get together, it's a part, you know, it's fun to make deals, it's fun. And you had to be in the office. That just was the culture, being in the office, being there every day, being at the store as when people came and all those things. That was important. And then always, anytime you get small groups together, and we do the mastermind groups in the community, small groups are critical to every human adventure that's ever happened, going back to small bands of tribes before civilization even existed of humans. So human interaction is going to be with us for forever, in my view. And, you know, unless we're dealing with inanimate objects, you know, or as from a real estate standpoint, you could buy a, you know, a 50-acre site in Antarctica, but and there's no need for any human beings because nobody will want to go there. So anyway, any place where people want to interact, human relationships and business relationships will be there.
Makes sense. I guess last question I had for you, John, is you've been involved in a lot of deals in your life. I'm curious if you have any interesting stories or deals that highlight kind of the importance of relationships.
Well, I will say that I'll just talk a little bit about my career, starting with the first job I had at Prudential Insurance Company. I saw with my mentor at the time that his relationships internally and then with the clients that he introduced me to, and I was a lender at the time. We were lending small industrial projects, and then he brought me into a couple of workout discussions on hotels and other things. It was interesting to see the interaction he had with those clients and how much trust the clients had in him. And what I learned when I started developing my own clientele on the lending side, which only lasted about a year because the markets went into oblivion because interest rates rose into the high double digits, almost, you know, close to 20% when I was a year and a half into my job. So we more or less shut down, and then it changed a lot. But I learned right then what relationships mean in our business. And then I just kept doing it. When I became a real estate broker, I learned about team building internally with teammates to go and sell projects. And then, of course, client relationships were critical to having that. And then learning how to negotiate, giving and taking, all that, you know, relationships are absolutely critical. And then everything I've done basically since being in Washington, the mortgage banking community, joining the Urban Land Institute, see all the different organizations I've been involved in. And then my business, you know, the mortgage banking is an intermediary. You've got to have relationships. You've got to have, that's how you make your money. You got to develop relationships. You have to understand the markets and be able to communicate that both to the borrowers and to the lenders to try to make deals. So, you know, you can't get any business done if you don't have good relationships. And that's one of the reasons I did the podcast, to emphasize that aspect of the real estate business. Is and every guest I had that had a successful business, that was one of their principal tenets, is building a good reputation and strong relationships with integrity. So that's the bottom line in our industry.
Yep. I could not agree more. Well, that's all I had. Great interview. Really loved hearing from David and just getting his story. And I'm excited because it sounds like you're going to have Bo on the podcast as well. Is that right?
It hasn't lined up yet. I think I'm going to wait a little while to separate them. Interestingly, I did interview Kathy Bonifay. She was like my third or fourth interview on the podcast. And I didn't think about bringing David on until he made the move to Mankiti, frankly, because, you know, he'd been with Horning Brothers for over 20 years. I would have eventually gotten to him. But when he made that move, I thought it was a bold enough move to get it, bring him on sooner as an icon, to be honest with you, because I thought it was a, you know, a bold move to, I mean, he said he was going to retire, quote unquote, even though he never used the word. He gave them 18 months notice before he left. So he didn't know what he was going to do until Bo and he had a conversation one day and they said, why don't you just come on and run it with me? So I thought that was a good enough story to have it on. So that's what I did. And I will wait for Bo a little bit. I've interviewed a lot of his competitors / you know, comrades in the industry, like J.R. Lynch, you know, Bua Beniti, who was a partner of his, Joe Carroll and John Green. These are all African-American successful real estate operators. Adrian Washington is another. So all those gentlemen I've interviewed for the podcast that are analogous careers to Bo, but I just haven't gotten to them yet. So we will probably later this year or early next year. Certainly, I will try to bring him on. I'd like to see him get some of those 2.8 million square feet projects under construction. So then I have a lot to talk about what he's working on. So
makes sense.
Yep. Great. So thank you, Kevin, for coming on and adding good questions and insights. I really appreciate it. And listeners, thank you for joining me for another episode. And just a sneak preview, my next guest will be Brad Doxer, who is the founder of GreenGen, which is a environmental and energy consulting firm. But he has a very interesting real estate background that we'll talk about. So look forward to that in the next couple of weeks. Thank you for joining me.